You're listening to Beyond the Ribbon, a podcast of the Cancer Survivorship Center, powered by 24 Hours in the Canyon. This podcast is brought to you by Auto Inc. Auto Inc. is a distinguished family of dealerships redefining automotive excellence. Be sure to check out their website at autoinc.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ribbon. My name is Ryan Parnell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and oncology nurse, Pam McMillan.
Hey, Ryan. How are you today?
Pam, I am really doing pretty good. How about you?
Good. I'm good. You know, oftentimes we hear in the cancer world a lot about hope.
Yes.
And I say hope. What does that mean to you?
Well, probably, honestly, a lot of things, right? You're putting your faith in something. You are feeling like this is going to happen and you want it to be good.
Right. You know, and hope is so different for everybody. And I think, you know, if you have doubts or you're questioning, then, oh, you don't have hope. I feel like that patients really suffer with what is hope.
Yeah. And that's kind of an unfortunate thing, right? To tell someone you don't have enough hope or you know, and I think the interesting thing is, as you said, is just like we say, cancer survivor means something totally different to each person. I think you're exactly right. Hope probably means a myriad of things and it probably changes, right?
Right. You know, whenever I was searching for podcast topics, we came across our guest today and I thought, how much can we talk about hope? And then I was pleasantly surprised when I read the book, and I really feel like every person listening to this podcast would benefit from reading that book.
No question. No question. Yeah. I remember that. And you ordered the book and I kind of looked at it and I thought, I don't know that there's not much. It seems really thin. Right. And these are not negative things to say, just, you know, very, very pleasantly surprised. Now listen, hey, enough talking about hope already, Pam, let's jump into this because I'm telling you, you guys listening today are in for a real treat. There's so much to discuss here. We're super excited all the way from the metropolis of Dallas. You know, we pull guests from all over the United States, and it's nice to have a fellow Texan joining us today. Let me just tell you about our guest. Her name is Wendy Harpum. She's a doctor of internal medicine, longtime cancer survivor, and national leader in survivorship. Wendy's three children were under 6 years old when she was diagnosed with lymphoma. She went in and out of treatment for over 17 years, including three clinical trials, which, you know, if you followed our podcast, we've done several episodes on clinical trials. We're big believers in clinical trials. Before entering her current remission, in 2021, she was diagnosed with aplastic anemia, which responded remarkably well with treatment. Wendy credits her extraordinary survival to expert and compassionate medical care, support of her family and community, and her ability to find hope. But not just any hope, healing hope, a hope that helps patients get good care and live as fully as possible. Ongoing illness forced her to retire from clinical medicine at 38 years old. She turned to writing, which is why we're speaking with her today. She also speaks to continue her mission of helping others through the synergy of science and caring. She's written 8 books, including 2 children's books. Since 2005, she's been writing an award-winning column in Oncology Times called View from the Other Side of the Stethoscope. The cool thing, too, is that Wendy has received numerous prestigious honors, including the Governor's Award for Health, which led to her induction, Pam, to the Texas Women's Hall of Fame. Dr. Harpum, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here with you.
You know, gosh, I told Pam, and we kind of teased this between the two of us, like, this is probably this book, Healing Hope, that you wrote. I feel like, and Pam said the same thing, it really is kind of a manual. It could be a manual for going through treatment.
Hope matters. Hope is essential for getting good care and living as fully as possible. I have yet, in 34 years of survivorship work, to meet someone who didn't agree that hope matters. And yet, when patients are in tough times, when patients have setbacks, they're facing a poor prognosis, You even mentioned it in the introduction. People will say, have hope. That's the beginning and the end of the conversation. That really doesn't help patients. Patients need to understand what hope is, how hope works, and their role in finding hopes that help them heal.
So what brought up this idea for the book? How did you come about, okay, I need to write about healing hope?
Because as a doctor and a patient, I believe that hope was central to getting good care and living as fully as possible. And nobody was guiding patients on how to find and cultivate hope. So I look back on everything I'd learned through my experiences. And you mentioned I'd been in and out of treatment for 17 years before treatment finally put my cancer into a remission that lasted. And I'm probably cured of my lymphoma. I just, Pam, I find it shocking that we don't teach patients how to find hope. So Healing Hope Through and Beyond Cancer you mentioned that it was a slim volume. It's illustrations, inspirational sayings, affirmations, and 200 words or less of text for each affirmation, explaining how to find hope.
Well, and the slim volume, don't be misled, folks. Do not be misled. Every single page is so powerful. And I'm not saying that just because you're here talking about this. When we prepare for a guest, we take some notes and Pam and I visit and we chat about it. And I remember going in there and I'm like, Pam, I'm like halfway through the book and I have 2 pages of notes already. And she's like, yeah, look at mine. I mean, so don't let us saying it's a very slim volume or, it is so powerful. And I think we always like to kind of start at the beginning and let's just define hope. What is hope?
Ryan, I'm going to share the story of how I came to my definition. I'd already written a number of books and I was writing a new book called Happiness in a Storm, which was going to share my 3-step approach to survivorship: knowledge, hope, and action. So when I got to the chapter on hope, I opened a blank screen on my computer, expecting to start off the way I usually start off with a new concept, with a definition. I sat there motionless, like a statue, stymied. Wow, I can't define hope. So off the top of my head. So what did I do? I went to the dictionary and I found all these conflicting different definitions of hope, which then sent me on a journey into the theology, philosophy, neurobiology, psychology literatures on hope. And that led me to a definition that I have found useful as a clinician and as a patient. And my definition is, hope is a feeling linked to a belief the desire can happen. Hope is a feeling linked to a belief that the desired outcome can happen. And there are 3 things to note about my definition. 1, it's a complex emotion. So fear is what we call a simple emotion. I can put a needle in a certain part of your brain and stimulate it, and you will experience fear, even in any context, in an operating room. But hope, a complex emotion, is when you have a feeling linked to a belief. So, and that's nothing unusual. I mean, what's shame? It's a very uncomfortable, unpleasant feeling linked to the belief you've done something wrong. Or what's pride? It's a very uplifting, pleasant feeling linked to the belief you've done something wonderful. So hope is a feeling linked to a belief. And the implications of that are profound, because anything affecting your belief can affect your hope. If a newly diagnosed patient believes the diagnosis is a death sentence, it's hard to find hope. If a patient believes that post-surgical changes, difficulty walking, fertility issues means they're damaged goods, means they're not lovable, that person may have trouble finding hope of feeling whole again or finding love. If a patient believes that entering hospice means everybody's given up and they've given up, if they believe entering hospice means they're dying right this minute, they'll have a hard time finding hope of living what time they have fully and even joyfully. So the first factor about hope is it's a feeling linked to a belief. The second factor to note is that hope is tied to time. It's a feeling you have now in the present linked to a belief about the future. You know, I hope my scans will be good. I hope I get through treatment. The implications of this feature of hope are also profound. Anything affecting your perception of the future affects your hope now. So let's say you're experiencing cancer-related pain or you're very fatigued from treatment. If you project that you're always going to feel like this, it's hard to find hope of a better tomorrow. And the third feature of hope is that it only arises in situations of uncertainty about outcomes that matter. So, Ryan, Pam, you guys are not hoping that my grandchildren sleep through the night tonight because that outcome doesn't affect your world. Neither are you hoping that the sun rises tomorrow. I mean, that's about the most certain outcome in the world. So to refresh, hope is a feeling linked to the belief that the outcome you desire can happen. And I think what's lost is that patients think that either you have hope or you don't have hope, it arises naturally, or it depends on the statistics. In fact, hope does arise naturally, but we can set the stage for hope and we can choose which hopes we focus on.
You also have a definition of healing hope. So what is the difference?
Okay. Thank you. Hope is a feeling linked to a belief the outcome can happen. Healing hope is hope that helps you get good care or helps you live as fully as possible. So, for example, I can hope, if I believe that eating 2 carrots a day will cure my cancer, if I really believe that, I can eat 2 carrots every morning and feel hopeful that I am curing my cancer. That hope is a real feeling, but it's not a healing hope if I choose to eat carrots instead of getting effective treatment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another example, you deal with patients every single day. When we all talk about scan anxiety, the anxiety associated with evaluations. If I found a lymph node tonight and tomorrow morning I saw my oncologist who ordered a scan, what do you think I would be hoping for between the time my oncologist gave me the requisition and the time that I got the results? What would I be hoping for?
Good scan.
Good news. Everybody hopes for good news. What I found is that for Wendy, that was not a healing hope because it didn't help me get good care and it didn't help me live as fully as possible during the period of uncertainty. I mean, think about it. I'm hoping for good news, but I can't do anything to make it good news, right? It's going to be what it's going to be. And it didn't help me wait for the results. The other thing is, whenever I shared that I was undergoing tests, people would say, I'm hoping for good news, or you got to hope for good news. And I felt so much pressure to hope for good news. And it was a couple of years into my survivorship when I realized there was really something better for me to hope for. And I say me, Wendy, and that is hope for accurate news. And let me show how this hope helped me. When I go to have the test, and I've had pain associated with my cancer, so sometimes holding still on the CT scanner was very uncomfortable. It was difficult. My hope for accurate news gave me the fortitude, gave me the strength to hold as perfectly still as I could so the test would be as clear as possible, so the test would be as true as possible. And then when, after I get off the scanner and I'm waiting for the results on the portal or a call from my doctors, that hope for accurate news gave me patience, because I wanted my doctors to take their time scrutinizing the scans, talking among themselves, being sure they knew what it showed before they reported it to me. The other thing is that hoping for accurate news gave a nod to the possibility that the news would be disappointing, upsetting, which meant it helped prepare me for any news. And then if the results were what I feared, I didn't blame myself. And if you think about it, which is the news that helps you most when you get scans? Is it good news? What if that good news means it just missed what was going on? You know, how many times have we gotten the test and been told, looks good, and then further testing shows what's really going on? Mm-hmm. What good news will make me happy, but the news that will help me most is the news that tells us what's going on so we can respond in ways that help me. Now, understand, when I get that requisition for a scan while I'm waiting for the results, of course I want good news. I hope for good news. As a healthy survivor, though, I've learned to let that hope drift into the background. And I consciously have disciplined myself to focus on hope for accurate news. I think about it. I talk about it. You know, if somebody says to me, Wendy, I hope you get good news. And I say, well, I'm actually hoping I get accurate news so we know what's going on and we know what to do.
Yeah, it makes a big difference to have a plan, you know, to be able to, I feel like I've said this before. I'm just glad they figured out what's going on, you know?
Right. Like right. And in terms of hope, I mentioned that hope occurs during periods of uncertainty. So you might say, well, why does hope matter? It's because hope motivates to take actions that can help during the period of uncertainty. And when there's nothing we can do, hope helps us wait. So using this example of waiting for test results, choosing a hope that helps you through the uncertainty is a healing hope. Now, I've been at survivorship groups where, and hope is very personal. Ryan, it's really important to emphasize that I don't have an answer of hope that helps everybody, but I think I have, the Healing Hope book shows people how they can find the best hopes for them. I have met people who, between the time they get the requisition and the time they get the results, what helps them most, what calms them most, is hoping for good news. Mm-hmm. And that's great if it works for them. What I'm sharing is that I realized that hope was only making me more anxious, making me feel more vulnerable. And for other survivors who share that sense of increased anxiety while hoping for good news, introducing the option of hoping for accurate news, let them try it on for size and see if for them, it helps them the way it helps Wendy Harpum.
So if we have a survivor out there fixing to go get a scan tomorrow, what is your advice for finding hope for them?
I will share the fact there is hope. The results will be good. Mm-hmm. I focus on the uncertainty. You know, I realize there is uncertainty. And we are prepared to take care of you, whatever the results show. The reason that's so important is, again, if people are pressured to hope for good news, it's almost asking them to defy logic, to say, it's going to be good. But heck, if we knew it was going to be good, we wouldn't be getting the scan, right? We'd know the result. So I think acknowledging the uncertainty, acknowledging the possibility that the results may be disappointing or upsetting, and linking that with confidence that it will help us, that unwanted news is helpful news, that we can deal with unwanted news and we'll have a plan and we'll move forward and we'll be there for you, is helpful.
Yeah.
The other thing that helps is distracting yourself, meaning once you've done what you can do to optimize the outcome, distracting yourself during the period of uncertainty. In fact, there's one picture in the Healing Hope book where I have somebody, I think, vacuuming and dusting and whatnot at the same time. I definitely get more anxious before scans or when I have a worrisome symptom. And I've learned to leverage that excess energy to be more productive, whether it's organizing your sock drawer or writing another book. You know, I say, I accept I'm going to be more anxious. What do you expect? And then using that excess energy productively. So distraction, being productive with the excess energy, getting your support group. And the other thing is planning something good for the future, whatever the results are. You know, whatever the results are, after my scans are over, I'm going to my favorite place for lunch.
Yeah.
You know, putting those points of happiness out there.
Wendy, I'm a real visual person. And I was really struck by the cover of your book. And then, because I thought, what in the world? Why is there a flashlight on the cover?
Uh-huh.
And then, and Pam even said, what was one thing that really struck you? And I told her, right, Pam, the flashlight. Discuss with our listeners your flashlight analogy, because I think it's very powerful.
I use hope and the light of a flashlight. I use the light of a flashlight as symbolic for hope, because imagine you're walking through a forest in the dark and trying to find safe footing for moving toward your destination. A flashlight, even though it doesn't show the whole picture, may help you find each step forward, help you avoid dangers. And it only helps you if you're pointing it in a useful direction. In other words, if you point it off into the treetops, that's it'll still be hope, but it's not actually going to lead you toward your desired destination.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I love the metaphor of a flashlight, because it's not like you turn it on, you feel hope, and then you feel hope forever. Hope is a feeling, and all feelings in human beings are fleeting, which means you need to constantly be recharging the batteries of your hope. Another useful aspect of the metaphor is that hope is mechanical, right? You have a battery, you have the bulb, you have the connection. Human beings experience our inner and outer worlds through the electrochemical workings of our brain. And while hope is a feeling, it does require the brain to fire in a certain pattern for us to experience what we call hope. That's important, because if for some reason the chemistry of your brain is off, either due to a tumor pressing on part of the brain or drugs in your brain, certain chemicals can affect the brain, the workings of the brain, chronic stress affects the chemistry of the brain. It may be hard for a patient to feel hopeful, not because they have weak will or because they don't have faith or because they don't know the fact, that there is hope, meaning a chance, but the chemistry of their brain may be making it difficult to feel hope, just as damage or injury to the brain can make it difficult for somebody to speak properly or to move their arm, such as after a stroke. And attention to the chemistry of the brain also matters in matters of hope. And when I say that, I'm not just talking about, for instance, using anti-anxiety medicines or anti-depression medicines as a bridge while somebody either gets better physically or adjusts to the shock and the disruption of a new cancer diagnosis. But the idea that the chemistry of the brain is affected by all the factors coming up into it. So even while dealing with the chronic stress of cancer and recovery, taking steps to help the chemistry of the brain can be what it takes to help you find hope, such as eating well, such as getting some exercise and getting the blood flowing, such as having moments when people, if you like being touched, people give you a massage or people stroke you or people hold your hands, such as laughter, such as, you can't see it, but in my study, I painted the walls bright rose and the doors are great purple. Now, yes, some people who come in my study start laughing or like, what was Wendy thinking? But pink and purple make me happy. And so painting the walls is one more factor that helps my brain get in a place that it's a little bit easier to feel hopeful and easier to feel happy. That said, when I get unwanted news, when I find out my cancer recurred, it's not going to be a good day. I'm not going to be happy. And I may not be hopeful at first. The important message is that you don't stay there. I'll share another idea, and that is that everybody, if I had a nickel for every time somebody said, Wendy, you need to be positive. You need to be positive. Well, a positive attitude for me is not being happy and cheerful and optimistic and sure of a good outcome all the time. A positive attitude is whatever attitude today helps me get good care and live as fully as possible. Now, if I get news that my cancer is back, I think a very healthy, appropriate response is to cry or be angry or be disappointed or be shocked or be all those other what we call negative emotions, because they are my body's expression of learning and processing and then adjusting to unwanted news. And the thing is, after I cry or express my disappointment or anger, I can move on to, okay, what do I do now?
Yeah, what's next?
And that pressure, again, a lot of patients talk about the toxicity of a positive attitude. I used to joke that I think one of the reasons I've survived way on the right side of my survival curves is because I cried so much that when I was sad, I found safe places to cry and figure out how to deal with the loss. I didn't try to hide it. I didn't try to suppress it. I used it as a signal from my body that this is a hard time. This is unwanted news. I'm reacting like a human being. You know, when we lose something, we grieve. So I grieved. And then I found a way to accept, adjust, and move on. One example, all I ever wanted to be was a private practitioner. White coat, stethoscope, privacy of my office, caring for patients one-on-one where only the patient and I knew about this interaction. When my cancer came back a second time in 2 years, I had to leave clinical medicine. That was a devastating loss for me. It was the loss of, you know, who am I now if I'm not a clinician? Mm-hmm. I cried a lot. And that crying, I saw an oncology social worker, again, for a safe place to cry without added burden of my family. Because if you cry with a social worker, that's a professional setting and the social worker cares, but it's not really going to change the social worker's world. Whereas if I do that same crying with my husband, he loves me so much, it would hurt him to see me crying so much. So I kept my husband informed, and believe me, he saw plenty of tears too. But I did the work of grieving with a counselor, and I found a new way to be a doctor through my speaking and my books.
Yeah.
The message is that a positive attitude is whatever attitude helps you through today. And sometimes positive attitudes include finding safe places to express grief, justified anger. And the key is not getting stuck in it. The key is either on your own or with the guidance and support of friends, loved ones, professionals, understand what's going on, adjust to what's going on, and find new ways to live in this world changed by your cancer and its treatment.
In your book, you talked about, you know, reporting symptoms and how important it is to be accurate. You know, I know for some survivors, it's hard because they feel like they're complaining.
Right.
What advice would you tell them?
That in social circles, complaining is when you talk about something and you have no intention of making it better. Okay. And complaining is unpleasant for listeners hearing the complaining. Doctor visits are not social visits. As a doctor, I can tell you, I depend on patients being candid, forthright, and complete. If they hide symptoms from me, if they try to act better than they are, like if they minimize symptoms or keep secret their fears, anxieties, symptoms, that's like tying a hand behind my back. That's like leaving out, for a detective, that's like leaving out major clues that are available. My patients and I were on a shared mission to figure out what was going on and determine the options and choose the best option for that patient. All three elements are a team effort, meaning I bring my expertise to the effort, but I depend on the patient to tell me what is going on in their body and what is going on in their head between our visits. The more they tell me, the more candid they are, the better job I could do as a doctor to take care of them. As a patient, I experienced the hesitation, the desire to, for instance, keep secret when I messed up my medication by accident, or if they recommended doing something and I didn't do it for whatever reason. And the other thing is, I remember one time I got a fever at midnight, and at that time my blood counts were really low. Now, I absolutely knew the right thing to do. I needed to call my doctor right away. But when I put my hand on the receiver, I didn't dial the number for, I don't know, seconds ticked by, because I didn't want to wake my doctor. I didn't want to wake my husband, and I didn't want to wake a friend to come take care of my kids. And Pam, I didn't want to go back to the hospital. I didn't want to be sick again. So I hesitated to do what I knew to be the right thing. And the handle that has helped me, the handle that gives me hope, is saying, do the right thing no matter how you feel. Like, and I would say to my doctor, I'm embarrassed to tell you this symptom, or I'm embarrassed to tell you that I messed up my medication, and then I'll tell them the truth. And it's that commitment to doing my part in getting good care. And my part as a patient is to provide accurate, complete information, to give my doctors and nurses the clues they need to make the right diagnosis and to provide the best treatment. And when I say best treatment, I mean best treatment for me. Sharing truths about what matters to me helps the doctor tailor the decisions and the treatments for me.
Yeah. Pam, I'm glad you hit on that. That's one of the very first things that you and I talked about as well, was symptoms are symptoms and they need to be shared, and that the doctor visits aren't social, you know. And I told you about one of my recent doctor visits, and we spent 25 minutes, it seemed like, talking about family, which is all well and good, but then it's like, oh, and by the way, you're here to look at my shoulder, you know, let's talk about this. And I think it's so often that we hear, well, my doctor, I don't want to bother them, they took good care of me, or they did. No, you're the consumer, and you use, how much time is the statistics are crazy these days of how little time you get with a doctor.
Right, right. And that's why patients do the doctor a service and themselves a service by preparing for the visit. Yes. I'm a doctor and I still come in with an index card that I list my symptoms so that I don't leave the visit and go, dang, I forgot to bring up such and such. And the other thing is that it allows me to be very efficient in terms of presenting my things in order of importance to me. I can even show the card to the doctor, preparing my medication list so it's all ready. The other thing you make me think of is that one reason some patients say they're better than they are, like minimize pain or minimize their sadness or insomnia or whatever it is, they want their doctor to feel like he or she is a success. Let's say the doctor got you through really hard treatment. You know, you kind of want the doctor to feel like they did a good job and you're doing great. You're a success. But the point is to get you the best care. Your doctor wants, put it this way, doctor visits are not social visits. Doctors want to do a good job and they can do their best job when they know the truth about how you are between visits, physically, emotionally, socially, psychologically, spiritually.
You know,
the other thing that really hit home to me was that, you know, you want to report these symptoms, but a symptom is just a symptom until you get a
right. Diagnosis. And actually, that's the very first affirmation. Yeah. A cough is just a cough. Especially after you've had cancer, suddenly a headache is not just a headache. It's a, you know, could this be a brain tumor, a brain metastasis? Could this be a brain bleed? You know, you get a little bit of bleeding around your gum when you brush your teeth. It's like, oh, I got leukemia. And this is a very normal response for some patients after treatment to be worried that symptoms mean something. And the problem is they may. Mm-hmm. They may. And so what I've learned, there's a picture of a jar with a cap on it. And the jar is filled with all these questions. You know, let's say I have a new pain in my shoulder. The question is, what is this pain? And I need to focus on this shoulder pain is just a shoulder pain, or this cough is just a cough. My job now is to decide, do I wait or do I call my doctor? You know, do I wait and see if it goes away in a day or 2 days, or do I report it to my doctor today? All your attention and energy should be focused on making that decision. All the other questions that start to swirl around in your normal brain, such as what if it's recurrence? What if it's this? What if it's that? What am I going to do about my kids? What and all those questions that kind of like runaway train. Now I'm mixing my metaphors, forgive me. You put all these questions in the jar and close the lid and say, nope. I'm not going to, a cough is just a cough. My job is to focus on getting proper attention for the cough. I will deal with all those other questions depending upon what it turns out to be. And the reason I use the metaphor, I use the example of a cough is just a cough, is because there was one time a patient in my support group had been through treatment for a cancer where he had received radiation to his lung. And he spent weeks first hiding the fact that he had this irritative cough and the fact that he was worried it meant his cancer was back until he couldn't hide it anymore. And his wife finally forced him to go to his doctor. And workup showed that he was doing great and the cough was a post-treatment effect that they could then address. And the point is that him allowing all those other questions to swirl in his brain when he had a cough. What if it's cancer? What if it's cancer, then I won't be able to work. If it's cancer, blah, blah, blah. And he just went on this journey, you know, that paralyzed him from doing what he needed to do, which was to report the symptom, have it evaluated, and then go from there based on what it really was and what it wasn't.
Yeah.
And I think that you said it perfectly. Those are normal feelings for patients to have. You know, I know our counselor calls it the monkey mind, the what
right.
if, oh right. my God, it's the worst thing, but that is a normal feeling for patients.
And I think in terms of understanding hope, realizing that hope is a healing emotion during periods of uncertainty, if you choose and focus on hopes, that can help you. So again, if you have a cough, let's go back to this patient at my support group. I had a cough. He could hope it's not cancer, not recurrence. But is that hope sitting there? I hope it's not cancer. I hope it's not cancer. Is that helping him with the uncertainty?
No.
Whereas if he says, I hope I can get this evaluated, you know, I hope I can do the right thing. Hoping to do the right thing is a very good hope to have because it will drive him to overcome his hesitation to report the symptom. It will actually help him move forward, find out what's wrong, and respond to it in a healing way.
You know, I want to jump into some of the other topics throughout your book or headlines real quick, because I want our listeners to get maybe a little bit of a sense of little pieces and parts that maybe that rings a bell in their head of like, all of a sudden, ooh, I need that. That's me.
Okay.
You know,
go for it.
All right. Can we do that?
Absolutely.
So Pam, I know you did kind of the same thing as I did, as we talked, you know, and we're just going to hit a couple of highlights here. You talk about statistics don't predict, and I cannot imagine how many times through a cancer survivor's journey, they're told statistics. And so, you know, and how many times we've heard too, the statistics. You talk about everybody is different and everybody is different. And I think that's super powerful. Is there anything you want to add to those two before I move on?
Me?
Yes, Dr. Harper.
Honestly, I love them all. I know. A terrible answer.
They need to read the book to go through all of them.
Right. Well, okay. So
I like that, you know, false alarms are a reason to celebrate.
Yes.
You know, false alarms are part of survivorship. You have to jump through hoops. I have, because of all the, I've had a ton of treatment. And so when I get a pain, it's not like somebody else my age who gets a pain. We need to worry, is it recurrence? We need to worry, is it a complication of past treatment? And what that means is I've had a lot of false alarms. And instead of feeling, oh, I shouldn't have called the doctor. Oh, I jumped the gun. I reported my symptom too soon. It's like, no, you did everything right. And yay, you got the result you wanted. It's a false alarm. You're okay. I
like too, the cancer humor is good medicine. And we have talked about that. There's certain Instagram pages and, you know, people that you can follow that, you know, it might seem super dark and super uncomfortable to some people, but cancer folks get it. And we talk about that often. So,
humor is very empowering, you know.
Yes.
I'll share one joke that it was during my first couple of weeks of my first diagnosis, and I was sick and I was in pain and everything. And I turned the corner and bumped into the side of the wall. And I looked at my husband and said, oh, I'm not perfect anymore. And the two of us, I was laughing so hard because at the time I felt so broken and damaged and all that. And the fact that I could joke about not being perfect, you may have had to be there, but I'm telling you, the two of us, it released all the tension in the world. I was laughing so hard. I was crossing my legs. It was great.
You know, I go back to, we offered laughter class and Ryan looked at me like, what? And I can still picture the little lady with the big glasses on. And we had to pretend like we were going through a roller coaster and we laughed so hard. And so did everybody else at that retreat.
My cheeks hurt so bad. They laughed so much.
Laughter is good medicine, as they say. You know, the other thing that I really took away was no doctor can take away your sense of hope unless you let them.
Right. Hope is like love. It's like faith. It arises within you. And nobody can say or do anything that takes away your hope unless you let them.
You know, and that's hard when you get a bad report or, you know, your cancer has spread, you know, that you want to lose hope, but that's not your doctor's decision for you to take
right.
away.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I'm sorry to say that sometimes things are said by professionals that make it hard to feel hopeful. I've heard too many stories of someone seeing one clinician who will say, you know, go home and get your things in order. There's nothing I can do.
Yeah.
And the patient will say, well, the doctor took away all my hope. That doctor had no hope. And the patient could, the patient still could find hope by finding out, going to someone who would tell them what their options were. And honestly, even if there are no treatments available to treat a specific cancer, that doesn't mean we don't care anymore, meaning that there are still the idea of entering hospice and avoiding futile treatments, meaning treatments that have really no chance of helping. There is a lot of living to do when in hospice. The other thing is we've all heard stories of people who live longer in hospice than, I mean, Jimmy Carter, than President Jimmy Carter, than anybody expected. There are exceptional cases where somebody enters hospice and then a couple of months into hospice gets a call from their doctor, I just found out about a new trial. Are you interested? And the patient leaves hospice to do the trial. That's not the usual. I'm not going to paint this fake picture of, you know, Pollyanna. But the point is there is uncertainty when people enter hospice. And the idea of making the best choice for you by knowing what your choices are is important to finding healing hope for your situation.
Yeah. A couple more before I touch on my most favorite one that we'll leave for the last piece.
Okay.
I love that you say feeling good enough is good enough.
And
that is so powerful. I think also one that really hit me was we really don't need everyone to understand. And I think so many times survivors feel like they have to perform. They feel like they have to, you know, educate everyone and tell everyone and those kinds of things. And then the other one was we honor others by turning survivor guilt into gratitude. I know I've had discussions with folks struggling with survivor guilt.
Right.
I think that's a fantastic and powerful way to turn that and make it something positive. But Pam,
I found a better term for survivor guilt since the book was published, which is survivor qualms. You know, guilt is the feeling you have when you've done something wrong. The fact that you survived, you have not done anything wrong. You've done everything right. And your survivorship didn't like take away somebody else's chance of surviving. But qualms captures the idea that it's an unpleasant emotion when, for instance, you hear that somebody with the same disease that you're surviving died from it. So it's a natural reaction. It's an uncomfortable reaction, but it's not guilt. It's a mixture of sadness and puzzlement and mystery and choosing to turn it into gratitude is a way to honor that person.
Absolutely. My favorite one, and Pam, I know you'll agree with me. I just know. Healthy survivorship is always a work in progress. And I think that's what we believe here at the Survivorship Center. And we try to provide what we provide because we realize and recognize that there are times you need us. And maybe you feel great. How many times, Pam, have we seen somebody and then we don't see them for 8 weeks, 6 months, and then all of a sudden they come back and we haven't seen you in a while. Well, and so it's this work in progress of survivorship.
And that's because the situation is always changing. I mean, even if you go through treatment, achieve a cure, you're still going to be aging, and the effects of your past treatments may impact that aging process. You're always changing physically. The situation is changing, meaning my later courses of treatment were not options when I was diagnosed. So the landscape of treatment is always changing. Diagnostics are changing. And you're changing as you mature, as you have life experiences, as your relationships evolve. So yes, cancer, healthy survivorship is always a work in progress.
You know, Wendy, we could go on and on, but I don't want to give all the great nuggets to our survivors. I feel like they need
to. There's so much more. There's so much more.
I think we got to maybe a fourth of what I wrote down. But, I really appreciate you sharing your journey through your book, and teaching people about healthy hope, healing hope. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you and where they can find your book at?
I have a website called wendyharpham.com, WendyHarpham.com. On it, I have lots of links to some videos, to articles, to an inspirational page. And it also links to my blog, which is called Dr. Harpham on Healthy Survivorship. About 2 to 4 times a month, I publish a very short, 250 words or less, post on something having to do with getting good care or living as fully as possible. And I've been doing that since 2008. so that's been one of my passions. I think that answers your question.
Yes. Lots of information out there. I know I read several articles, and I truly appreciate your writing. And I feel like our survivors can really connect to what you're writing. So thank you.
And all the books are on Amazon and any major bookseller.
Absolutely. Yes.
So that brings us to our last segment. We are sponsored by the Auto Inc. family. Do you have an Auto Inc. inspiring moment that you can leave our listeners with?
I will share a poem called Hope. I told you about the time I opened a blank screen. I expected to dash off a definition. I was stymied. And the first thing I did when trying to write a definition was this poem just came out of my fingers. So I'm going to share my poem titled Hope. Hope. Hope is an image of goals planted firmly in your mind. When looking at life before you, hope lines the paths you find. Hope is a well of courage nestled deep within your heart. When faltering in fear and doubt, hope pushes you to start. Hope is an urge to keep going for limbs too tired and weak. When apathy stills all desire, hope sparks the fuel you seek. Hope is a promise of patience as you wait for distress to wane. When all you can do is nothing, hope pulls you through the pain. Hope is a spirit that lifts you should heaviness pull at your soul. When torn apart by losses, hope mends to keep you whole.
Love it. Thank you for sharing.
Yes. I know you've inspired some folks today. You inspired myself and Pam when we read your book, which is why we're doing this episode today. And we just can't encourage you guys enough to pick up Healing Hope and peruse through there. There's so much. As Pam said, we could talk for another 2 hours. And we've left you plenty of nuggets that we did not discuss. Again, I can't thank you enough for channeling your energies through your unfortunate situation of having to leave medicine at such a young age, and doing something different and still making that real positive impact.
It's an honor to do this work. It is my way of giving back for the expert in compassionate care that enabled me to be here today.
Yeah. Well, thank you again. And Pam, I think we always say we learn something, but boy, there is so much to learn here. Our sincere hope is that you will pick up this book. You will take a look at it. You know, one thing, Pam, that Wendy talked about was a safe place. And I know I've heard you, I've said it, we've explained that the Survivorship Center is a very safe place.
Yes. You know, what happens here stays here, and what you want to share with us stays with us. And so we want to make sure that everyone has a safe place to come and enjoy some of the things that we do. And, you know, like I always say, it takes just a little bit of your time and none of your money.
That's right. Exactly right. You know, as Wendy said, healthy survivorship is always a work in progress, and we can help you along that work in progress. We like to use the analogy of just advancing the ball down the field or advancing the ball down the court, whatever that looks like for you. If you need to speak to a counselor, as Wendy talked about, we have several that we can get you in touch with. All of these things, again, are entirely free. And we want to provide those things for the sincere hope that you will progress and achieve that healthy survivorship that we just talked about. Pam, I've really enjoyed today.
I have too. Thank you again, Wendy. And again, I can't encourage our listeners to go out and check the book enough. And if you would like to borrow the copy, stop by my office and I'll be happy to share it.
That's right. That's right. Also, be sure to check out our app, check out our website for our calendar of events. You know, we offer about 65 different classes a month, or 65 classes per month, not different. That'd be way crazy. But we do offer about 65 classes per month. Find something to get involved in and really get involved in a community that's here at the Survivorship Center. And then make sure you join us next time for another great episode of Beyond the Ribbon.
Thanks again for listening to Beyond the Ribbon. We'd like to extend a special thanks to the Auto Inc. family of dealerships, as they have supported the 24 Hours in the Canyon Cancer Survivorship Center since 2016. For more information on the Cancer Survivorship Center, please visit our website at 24survivorship.org.